Today, Opportunity Knocks. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Senator Gerard Rennick. Hello, Senator.
How you going, Martin?
Yeah, great. And thank you very much for sparing us some of your time. I think there's a really important conversation to be had just now, given post-COVID, and now the discussion is moving towards, you know, reconstruction of the economy and all of those things. And I know you've got some really interesting and potent views about some of that. But as we get into this, can we just start a little bit about yourself? Because you came into politics, you know, quite recently in the Senate, in the Liberal Party. And what's driving you to make that move into politics?
Okay, thanks for the question, Martin. Well, look, I got into politics last year at the age of 48. What drove me to get into politics was that I want to make sure that we leave the same opportunities for our children that our forefathers gave to us. I want to make sure that we stand up for Australians who try to stand up for themselves. And I want to bring back this notion that the role of governments is to actually provide essential services, not regulate us into exhaustion, for want of a better word. I think, you know, as I said in my maiden speech, in the last 30 years, we've seen we've sold a lot of the infrastructure that provides essential services, and we've marched on into the family home, bedroom and classroom and other things, telling everyone how to live their individual lives. And I do think there is a role for government. I'm not a libertarian by any means. But I think that's at the macro issue and not the micro level. But about my background, I was born in Chinchilla, a small town about 280 kilometres west of Brisbane. Grew up on a farm. My mother was a nurse. Went away to university, where I did a Bachelor of Commerce at University of Queensland. Worked back in Dolby for 3 years in public practice, that's tax and business services. Went overseas for what I thought was going to be 2 years, ended up spending 7 years over there. So had 2 years in London. Worked on the privatisation of British Rail, which was quite interesting, as well as with BBC. Then I got a job based out of Amsterdam for 3 years, where I had pretty much 8 months in Amsterdam, 8 months Norway, 8 months Brazil, 8 months the States, and then a few months in a few other countries doing various financial-related projects. Quit my job there, went travelling for 2 years around the world backpacking, came home, worked at the Bank of Queensland up here in Brisbane for 6 years, and I worked in tax and treasury and management accounting and systems implementations at the bank, and then I moved to Sydney for 7 years where I worked for Westfield, and I worked in treasury, tax and systems there as well. So I got a Master's of Finance when I was at BOQ, I got a Master's of Tax Law when I was at Westfield, came back up here about 5 years ago after the birth of our first son, had a couple of contract roles and thought, no, I want to do more than this. So I did think about going back into public practice, but public practice 2020 is nothing like it was when I first started back in 1994. You know, there's 50 versions of MyOB, there's the cloud, there's the lap, you know, there's computer-based software versions. You've got BAS statements you never used to have, FBT, Div 7A loans. It is just a nightmare in small business, and that's just in regards to taxation. That's not all the other regulations. So,
that's very interesting. And, of course, the point to make there is you've come then into politics via business and through being involved in a number of businesses and a number of locations. That's a bit unusual because many people in Canberra basically are machine politicians, aren't they?
Well, a few, yeah. Look, I couldn't give you the exact breakdown, but yes, there are some people who are sort of career politicians or bureaucrats or staffers, for want of a better expression, and then there's others who aren't. And look, that's how it is. At the end of the day, it's a means to an end. And I guess the thing is, if you have a strong set of values and convictions, the important thing is to deliver results.
No, fair enough. And, you know, you're now representing Queensland, of course. In the Senate, you've got the whole of Queensland there. So I guess there's a couple of angles on that. Queensland's very diverse, right? Because you've got Brisbane down in the, southeastern corner, and then you've got, a lot of regional areas. So how do you sort of read what's going on and what are in the minds of Queenslanders to be able to represent them?
Yeah, well, you're right, Martin. Queensland is the most deregionalised state. Look, the way I represent Queensland is basically, I guess, through my experience of having grown up on a small town. I went to school in Toowoomba, went to uni I've met a lot of friends from uni who basically came from regional Queensland. I stayed at a residential college at university. So I had friends from Ingham, from Mackay, from Rockhampton. I travel extensively, so I spend 4 to 5 weeks a year on what we call our wombat trips, where I drive around and meet the mayors and the local state members. My father was a councillor as well, so I've got some appreciation of the way councils work. And just basically through meeting and talking and reading and using my prior experiences and contacts to get a grip on how Queensland's going.
And what do you think the critical issues are, or the main critical issue that you keep tripping over as you go touring around and talking to people?
Well, look, I mean, I guess it's always about livelihoods. I mean, at the end of the day, our role is to basically make sure we provide essential services to people, whether it be, cheap business costs in power and energy, energy and water, for our farmers or business, right through to essential services such as hospitals and schools for, our families. And that's something that's very close to me. My mum was a midwife out at Chinchilla Hospital. And interestingly enough, when I grew up in Chinchilla, it had a population of about 3,000 people and it had a maternity ward and three midwives. Now, just recently, that maternity ward's been closed down because they couldn't get midwives to Chinchilla, which is now a town of 6,000 people. And it's not that far. It's 280 kilometres west of Brisbane. I mean, it's not too far away. They're the issues, I guess, especially in the regions. It's that decline in essential services like maternity wards. We lost our councils under the state Labor government up here. That still, is very harsh for people in small towns to accept. We've got laws. I should also mention we've got property out in Western Queensland in Mulga country, whereby now we can't push mulga trees, which, is basically a woody weed, for want of a better expression. I mean, there's something like 60 million hectares of this stuff. And in the 30 years we've been out west, most of our property now is encumbered with mulga trees. And what they've done is they've just locked these paddocks up and said we'll use them as carbon sinks, which has destroyed councils like Charleville, Quilpie, Cunnamulla, who are losing their farmers. So it's all very well, these farms get owned by corporations who live in the cities. Another big one in Queensland was the introduction of poker machines. So that's another example of money going from the regions back to the bush, superannuation money from the regions, back to the bush, back to the cities. So there's that, and you really feel it here in regional Queensland where, we are the most deregionalised state. So Brisbane, I think, has got 2 million people, and then the rest of Queensland has about 5 million people. And even though sure, Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast are in the southeast corner, they do not identify themselves as Brisbane people. They identify themselves as Gold Coasters or Sunshine Coasters. Wide Bay is a massive, very rapidly growing area. So it's, it's looking for a dual highway all the way up to Bundaberg, and so they should, because the traffic between Rockhampton down to Noosa, where you start the dual highway, it's horrendous. That Bruce Highway is a real go track that we've got to continually, widen and upgrade as the population grows. So, yeah, there's some of the issues, I guess.
Okay, so it sounds as though some of them are growth-related and some of them are just basic economic equality and access to opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah, regionalised. And as I actually said in my pre-selection speech, not the one I did in Parliament, but to the LNP, I mean, when I first moved to Brisbane in 1988, Brisbane was still a big country town. And I actually gave that speech at the exhibition grounds and I said it was great to give it here because this is where, we met our family from the bush, and Queensland's always, and Brisbane's often been referred to, I think sometimes disparagingly, but I actually think we should be proud of it as a big country town, probably a bit rich to call it that now, but there was a nice flavour about it when, there was a less of a difference between the big city and the country. And I think that we should always aspire to make sure we give everyone an equal opportunity, equal opportunities, whether they are from the bush or the cities.
Okay. Now, I've had a chance to read a couple of your speeches, including your maiden speech. And, I have to say it was pretty potent and that you highlighted a whole lot of issues there. And perhaps we can just go through some of them, probably not all of them. But I want to start with infrastructure because you made some really, really important points about the fact that we aren't really thinking about infrastructure right across Australia. And I guess now this is becoming a really critical issue.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the role of government is to build and own infrastructure. This idea that privatising infrastructure works and that the market's going to fix it, I think it's been a complete failure. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, most infrastructure is monopolistic in its nature or oligopolistic. Sorry, got that wrong. You know what I mean? There's not genuine competition in the market, number one. And number two, there's not a not a lot of elasticity in the market as well, right? So, for example, if I get bitten by a snake in a paddock, I'm not going to sit on the phone, you know, in regional Queensland, sit on the phone and ring up Sydney, Melbourne and Perth to find the cheapest hospital to get attended to, right? So I'm going to go to the nearest hospital. And it's the same with electricity, right? Like, you come home at night, you turn on a power switch, it's the same power line that runs to your house, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, ironically enough, 20 or 30 years ago, everyone said privatise electricity and let the market fix it. And, of course, this year we've been, you know, encumbered with this, well, you know, the energy industry wants the government to give it certainty, to provide them, put some certainty in the market. Well, that's not the way the market works. The market is you know, driven by risk and uncertainties. So you can't have it both ways whereby they want, you know, market-based solutions, but then when those solutions don't sort of give the returns they want, come back to the government looking for handouts. I mean, if you look at the energy market in particular, I think there's something like 10 or 12 different regulatory bodies. Now, when something's regulated to that extent, the government may as well own it because it's, you know, it's death by regulation, right? And if we look through history, I mean, Hamilton started the National Bank in the late 1700s to power the US, the fledgling US nation. Macquarie used it with the Holy Dollar. He, you know, basically used currency to generate infrastructure. And an example, look at China. I mean, 60 years ago, these guys were coming out of the Cultural Revolution and were really struggling. Now, somehow in 50 years, they've managed to bring almost 1 billion people out of poverty. They now are a debtor nation to the US. They've built high-speed rail, dams and everything like that. They have based their economy first and foremost on infrastructure, which I would call the backbone of the economy. And they've been very clever about it, as was Lachlan Macquarie, as was Hamilton, you know, as was Roosevelt with the New Deal. They've used the country's currency to fund infrastructure. And, you know, so I'm just going to jump a little bit onto monetary policy here, because to get infrastructure built, we need to finance that infrastructure. Now, one of the things that's been choking infrastructure development in the last, well, I'm not sure when these rules started to come in, but there's these benchmark laws that the bureaucracy has introduced whereby they have to, infrastructure has to achieve a desired rate of return within 30 years. Now, if we're going to go out into the markets and borrow money at 4 or 5%, I know it's a bit lower now, but we've got to borrow money at 4 or 5%. And you've got to build the dam. So, say it takes 10 years to build the dam, it possibly 10 or 15 years with all the green tape we have now. You are never going to achieve a rate of return in the first 30 years of a dam, for example, right? So therefore, every sort of infrastructure project is just about kibosh now, because there's this idea it's got to achieve a benchmark rate of return. And, of course, when they work out these assumptions, because it's all based on modelling, of course, they exclude the uplift in property values, they exclude the, you know, increased tax collections from, you know, workers pay PAYG tax, you know, the contractors who build these things will, you know, pay profit company tax on their profits, et cetera, right? So we've almost been, what, well, I don't know, what white taped out of building infrastructure projects. Now, coming back to the monetary policy side of things, if we, the government was to set up an infrastructure bank and provide basically free capital to build this, a dam, for example, suddenly your finance costs aren't holding you back anymore. Because if you're going to, say, let's say it takes 30 years to generate a return on a dam and you've borrowed, you know, 2 or 3% for 30 years, you're going to pay, not only do you have to repay the capital, you've also got to repay almost, you know, the same amount in interest. So you're basically being choked to death by financing costs. As well as that too, if you've secured that dam against foreign debt, it's the foreign creditor who actually has security over that dam. And I don't want my children to grow up in a country whereby their infrastructure assets are securitized against foreign banks. I don't see why we can't have a national bank to basically fund infrastructure. And I really think, given that, you know, the slowdown we're going to have out of COVID, we're rapidly approaching, you know, $700 or $800 billion debt federally, and plus that, if you add the state debt in it, we're going to be hitting $1 trillion. We are never going to repay that level of debt, including interest, without that cost having a severe drag on the economy. And people get confused with capital, and, you know, I'll openly, you know, argue with my colleagues on my side of the fence in the coalition. They always go, we need foreign capital. And I always retort to them, well, what's the weighted average cost of capital? I just say, what is capital, number one? And there's only two types. There's debt or equity. And how do you calculate the weighted average cost of capital? And they can never even tell me what capital is, right? So they can, a lot of them actually confuse capital with assets. But assets is on the left side of the balance sheet. Capital, debt or equity is on the right side of the balance sheet. Now, I was taught way back in business principles that your assets are represented by capital. But capital is a function of your assets. And a country has two types of capital. It has wealth that we've already exploited, and it has untapped wealth. Now, if we're going to untap that wealth through foreign debt, that means that effectively we're handing that asset, giving control of that asset over to a foreign creditor. Now, we're supposed to be a sovereign country. And I always say, you know, there's four defining features of a country. Number one is clearly defined borders, a military to defend those borders, a taxation system, and a monetary system. And you cannot control your economy if you don't control the currency. And if you look at Lachlan Macquarie, he rocked up here in 1810, just after the Rum Rebellion. Modern Australia's fledgling colony had relied on foreign debt for the first 20 years. And it ended up, I think there was a bit of a drought or something in the mid-1800s, early 1800s, degenerated into the Rum Rebellion where they started trading rum. You know, Lachlan Macquarie was the first governor to see Australia not as a colony but as a, you know, fledgling new country. So he realised they needed a currency to control the economy. So he introduced the Holy Dollar, which, of course, today is the logo for Macquarie Bank, who just happens to own a large chunk of Australia's infrastructure. So, you know, if we want to get control of our economy, we need to get control of our currency, and the next thing after that, and to control our fiscal policy, is to control our infrastructure. And if we can fund infrastructure through our own capital, now, we'll have this argument. People will say, what about inflation? Inflation's caused when demand exceeds supply. So if you print and spend, that's not the right thing to do, right? Because you'll increase demand. If you print and invest and you build more dams, you build more power stations, you build more roads, you'll drive down the cost of water, you'll drive down the cost of power, you'll drive down the cost of freight. So you increasing the supply should help to push down the cost of essential services. And not only will you provide cheaper services to our businesses, you'll create jobs and you'll provide essential services as well. So that's, you know, to answer your question as to why I believe infrastructure is the key to driving economic growth. That's it.
Very interesting. And one question, of course, because the Commonwealth Bank was originally that public entity, wasn't it? And then it was privatised. So what's your perspective in terms of the privatisation of, the financial system? And does that put barriers in the way of investing in infrastructure?
So I subscribed to the recommendation in the 1937 Banking Royal Commission that recommended that the central bank should control the volume of money in the economy with an eye on the way private banks distribute it. Now, what's happened, Paul Keating let the foreign banks in 1985, and the RBA is basically only controls the economy through qualitative easing, i.e. changing interest rates. They don't change the supply of money. They let the foreign banks do that, and they let the privately owned banks via the foreign banks, so, you know, CBA or BOQ or whatever, go to offshore markets, borrow from there and then inflate houses. So the RBA has to become more assertive in terms of the volume of money it controls. By all means, you know, the banks, you know, the private banks can have a say in the distribution of it as per the 1937 Banking Royal Commission, but the RBA or our central bank needs to control the volume of money in the system. And that is very critical right now because we have, and there's an article in one of the blogs on the weekend about how Goldman Sachs has estimated about $20 trillion has been printed by central banks in the last decade. We're about the only central bank, not that we're a major central bank, but we, you know, the, and interestingly enough, and the RBA did do a little bit of expansion there at the start of COVID. It was a $90 billion facility for the private banks on the secondary market. So how is it that the RBA can aid private banks, but they can't aid infrastructure development through an infrastructure bank or help the taxpayer, pay for some of these bills in what is an exceptional circumstance under, you know, any conditions?
Well, it's quite fascinating there because I survey small businesses, and of course small businesses are having great difficulty in getting the funding that they need to invest in their businesses from the banks, right? And in fact, the banks seem to me to be much more interested in making more mortgage lending rather than actually supporting the development of the broader economy and businesses, which of course are our future.
Absolutely. This is one of the key reasons why, if you go back to that 1937 Banking Royal Commission recommendation, the RBA should keep an eye on the distribution of money. Now, you know, they need to be nudging banks to lend to small business, albeit, and, you know, look, you know, it's it's not secured lending. So I get that the banks have to manage their risk. But, you know, what banks have to understand is houses only hold their values while the people living in them have jobs to go to. And eventually we're slowly snuffling out our small business innovation and entrepreneurship as it becomes, yeah, cost of capital becomes dearer, regulation becomes more. And then and another pet topic of mine, I'll just deviate to short, quickly, is the cost to taxes in this country, right? So I would love to get rid of payroll tax. I'm actually a big fan of bringing back stamp duty on share trading and to abolish payroll tax. Now, to all the investors out there, I would argue if you got you paid a small upfront fee in stamp duty, you would be more than compensated by the increase in dividends if you hold long term, because the big, you know, big industrials, not that there's many of them left, but wouldn't have to pay payroll tax, so that you would get it back in increased dividends over the years. And we would, classic case of activity-based costing, we would put a tax on short-term speculation and take a tax off payroll tax, which is just madness. And then the other thing I'd like to point out is, and I picked this up through my Masters of Tax Law and working down at Westfield, our onshore tax rate's 30 cents. Now, I don't want to lower that, just be very clear about that, but our offshore tax rate, because of the tax treaties, is between 0 and 10 with our major trading partners, right, with the exception of dividends. But on above-line profits like interest, royalties and rent, the withholding tax rate on that's, you know, with the US, for example, it's 0 on most of them, right? So that means our onshore tax rate's 30 and our offshore tax rate's 0. Now, we have to eliminate that arbitrage, or at least minimise it to the extent that we can, so that it's – because, yeah, and I'll say this to my free marketeers who say, let's have foreign capital onshore. Actually, before we need to attract foreign capital, we actually need to stop our retained earnings going offshore, because what's happening at the moment is we attract capital in and then it just goes straight out the back door through above-the-line profits like interest, royalties and rent. And as I say to people, you know, when we shut down General Motors, how many people actually asked the question, how much in interest, royalties and rent did General Motors pay back to Detroit or an offshore hub of Detroit? Do you know how much it was? It would have been enough to make sure they never made a profit here. Because had they made a profit here, they'd have paid 30 cents in the dollar. So the whole idea, if you're a multinational with either a subsidiary overseas or a head office overseas, you're going to look for every measure you can to ship that profit offshore. Now, over the years, we've tried to tackle it through arm's length pricing or transfer pricing under the arm's length rule. But the problem is that shirt you're wearing, is it worth $5, $50 or $500? You know, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? So, you know, you get these, you'll end up in front of court arguing over the true value of something, and it's very difficult to prosecute. So, but my point is, if ideally you'd have an offshore tax rate above the onshore tax rate. But before we go there, we've also got to remember that we've got an income tax rate on the average worker of between 32 cents and 45 cents in the dollar. So it's not fair to lower a company tax rate to 25 cents if the average worker is paying 32.5 cents plus 2% Medicare. Because then there's a 10% arbitrage, almost 10% arbitrage between taxes on labour and taxes on profits. And ideally, we should flatten the difference between there as well, so that we don't have this tax distortion between different types of profits.
One of the questions that I wanted to touch on, you mentioned monetary policy earlier on. We've got this thing called the Council of Financial Regulators, which is, you know, the Reserve Bank, ACCC, ASIC, and, you know, a few others there as well, including Treasury. And they seem to be, if you like, at the heart of setting monetary policy. Do you think that's working?
Look, I'm not a big fan of the independence of the RBA. I know some people are going to freak out when I say that, because my problem with independence is, where's the accountability? I mean, where was the accountability when the RBA dropped interest rates from, say, 5 to 6% that gave a decent return on interest deposits, on deposits, down to 0.25%? You know, that's just happened, and we've destroyed the incomes of, well, say, we, the RBA, has destroyed the incomes of our retirees, and also inflated house prices, which has destroyed the aspirations of our younger people. And this has just all seemed to happen, and no one questions the RBA for what they've done. Now, I get that there's always political risk when the politicians run monetary policy as well. And, you know, let's face it now, monetary policy isn't even discussed. But I think monetary policy should be just as contentious as fiscal policy, because it's, you know, our economy is driven by, you know, the very broadly speaking, two levers, monetary policy and fiscal policy. And half of our, you know, half of the policy or monetary policy isn't even sort of held to account. So, I'm not overly happy with the fact the RBA has only ever used qualitative easing and doesn't go back to quantitative easing or tightening, as Paul Volcker did on the 6th of October 1979. That was the first time the central government came out and made a big announcement. And he actually tightened monetary supply to try and tame inflation. And, you know, it's that the amount of credit in the system is very important. I mean, we've had a population growth from 19 million to 25 million people in the last 20 years. How have we expanded monetary supply? How have we expanded credit in the system? I mean, the RBA hasn't done it. It's actually been done via foreign debt, you know, which has undermined our sovereignty. So, so I'm not happy. And the other thing is, I'll just have a crack at ASIC here. I'm very annoyed with ASIC because they changed the rules from 15 to 25% in terms of accelerated non-renounceable offers under the COVID laws. Now, if you had a rental property and you gave it to a rental agent, to, you know, rent out for 12 months and you came back 12 months later and it sold 25% of your rental property to his mates for less than market value, would you be happy with that? You wouldn't, would you? And yet that's what's happened on the stock market now. These so-called brilliant CEOs who are paid millions of dollars because they know so much didn't have an unused liquidity facility there that they could have tapped into in the short term it takes to do a pro-rated renounceable offer. And you look at the likes of Cochlear, I think he raised $850 million, of which $800 went to non-existing shareholders. I mean, where's the equity in that? So I'm not really all that happy with ASIC either. And they get to change this as well. That doesn't have parliamentary oversight as well. My father told me about that. He read about it in the paper. And he lives in Western Queensland. And I was like, this is when we shut Parliament down. And I was like, I had to look into it. And I realised, you know, suddenly occurred to me, because I've always had a, you know, I've never liked the accelerated share offers for that, as I've just explained. And I was thinking, well, this is happening under my nose and I'm supposed to be around this stuff. So, you know, I don't like the fact that these guys are considered experts. And take APRA, for example. They were actually part of the RBA. So, you know, the RBA split from the CBA, then the RBA, I think late 90s, APRA split from RBA. So then it's a case of all of this, right? Who's responsible? Oh, well, APRA, RBA, ASIC, ACCC. So I think that there needs to be greater scrutiny and parliamentary oversight of our monetary and regulatory settings in the financial system.
Mm. And it's interesting, of course, because all the conversations from the Reserve Bank and from APRA are about financial stability, right? And it seems to me that they are focusing very much on propping up the financial system, but not actually thinking about the impact on the real economy.
Exactly. It's they just don't want to take any risk whatsoever. I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious here, but I think it's worth saying. It reminds me of when Homer Simpson stayed home from work and was in his moo-moo dress and he just had the dippy bird, you know, hitting the yes button. Because sometimes when I read those RBA minutes, I seriously have to ask myself what's changed from month to month. And it's this, you know, Pollyanna view of the world, everything is awesome. And look, Australia's a great country and we're doing okay. I don't want to be pessimistic or anything like that. But, you know, we've also got to be cognizant of the risks out there and where we can make improvements. Because especially, you know, with the recent monetary printing by the other central banks around the world. Now, that's a real risk because a lot of that money that's been printed off other countries' printing press is looking for a home. And if we're not careful, it's going to come here and either do one or two things. It's going to buy our infrastructure assets, or number two, they'll lend us the money. So, you know, when the RBA issues these bonds in the primary market, it'll be foreign governments buying this, buying these bonds, and we'll be paying interest that pays the retirements of people in other countries. So, you know, we really need to have a look at capital controls to make sure that money that's been printed on other printing presses doesn't end up here buying up our assets. Because how can our producers and our industries compete against foreign industries when they've got access to free capital and we have to pay for it? Our guys have to pay for it.
Mm. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but just two quick questions. The first one is, what's your view on the question of migration and population? Because, you know, at the moment, migration is turned down because of the COVID. There are calls from many people to open the floodgates again and bring more people into the country. Do you think that will be a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, look, it's a question of the ability to absorb immigration. I mean, immigration in itself doesn't have to be bad, but, you know, we've got infrastructure constraints in this country, number one. We've got environmental constraints in this country, number two. And we've got what I call a skilled, a will shortage in this country, not a skill shortage. So, you know, we've got a lot of our young people now going to universities, and they all want to be doctors or lawyers or whatever, but we have a real lack in what I call TAFE skills. So I think we need to get our own settings right before we go back to the high levels that we had before. And ideally, permanent migration over temporary migration. I mean, as I pointed out in my main speech, we've got almost 2 million, or I think it's over 2 million now, temporary visa holders. Look, you know, that's just become a nightmare to manage in itself, right? We saw that with COVID, how, you know, some of these guys were left stranded. So, look, our immigration settings need to be adjusted to suit our economy, and I think we've got to deal with some of our own economic constraints first before we turn on the taps with immigration. I think we should go back to a long-term average of closer to 100,000. Even that, I'd probably give it a couple of years just until we recover from COVID, because there's going to be a lot of unemployed Australians looking for work. And I'm not convinced, and look, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm not convinced that with technology like it is today, that every new immigrant creates a new job. Technology, I think one of the biggest things we're facing outside of what I'd call government, you know, taxation, monetary, federation reform or whatever, is technology and the fact that jobs, and I guess this has been a problem for 200 years, but, you know, we've always got to make sure we're at the forefront of those new technologies that absorb job losses in other areas. We need to also make sure we've got a good handle on that as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting, of course, because many would argue, and I think I probably would agree with them, that a lot of the economic activity that's been created in Australia and the GDP number is being supported juggles more people. If you look at productivity on a per capita basis, it's not really grown very much at all. So we don't actually get the efficiency in the economy, we just get more people.
Well, my view is don't look at GDP at all, number one. If you're going to look at GDP or economic indicators, not that I do, I'm an accountant, GNP is the number you need to look at, because GNP is what measures goods and services made by Australian industries. Now, I read this number, and I'll please take with a grain of salt that the mining industry is 75% foreign owned. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, even if it's 60 or 70% foreign owned, if we're doing well because iron ore exports are high and, you know, whatever percentage is foreign owned, then that's not really dividends coming back to us. Admittedly, we do pick up payroll taxes and you know, the workers there. But having said that, BHP and Rio are automating a lot of trains there as well. But the numbers we should, I'll always go back to double entry bookkeeping. And, you know, I think, you know, if my view on Treasury needs to be, I hope that they've got some decent accountants in there, because, you know, GDP, make a pizza for 9, sell it for 10, GDP of 19. Make it for 10 and sell it for 9, GDP of 19. But accounting-wise, make it for 9, sell it for 10, accounting profit of 1. Make it for 10, sell it for 9, accounting loss at 1. And the problem with economic indicators is they don't look at how that spending's been financed. Has it been debt or equity? Has it been domestic funding, foreign funding? There's things like that as well you've got to look at in terms of quality of indicators as well, which I think accounting principles have a much better handle on than the economic make it up whatever you want it to be type of figures. So sorry there. I hope I'm not offending any economists out there, but I'm probably more partisan in terms of accountants versus economists than I am liberal versus blue collar labour. But
Well, it's just true, isn't it? Because if you just say it's about activity, more activity is better. It doesn't necessarily. It depends on how it's created and what the outcome is, all of those things. So I think the move away from GDP as being the end objective into something else, I think it's pretty important, actually.
Yeah, and I will remember there was the ABC News about 10 years ago, might have been 12 years ago, and GDP figures came out one quarter, and it was the first quarter when online betting was introduced, and there was a spike in GDP because of online gambling. Yes. Well, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't really call that a productivity increase.
Yeah. No, indeed. Another quick question then. What's the relationship between the federal government and the state governments looking like now? And, you know, do you think it needs to change, or do you think it's working well?
Look, I would like to see reform of our federation. I think at the, you know, as I said in my maiden speech, we've got vertical fiscal imbalances and ambiguous responsibilities. Health, for example, the federal government looks after PBS, Medicare, private health, aged care, NDIS. State governments look after public hospitals only, or, you know, there's allied healthcare things as well. But so who's responsible for health? Likewise with education. Federal government funds childcare, private primary and secondary schools, and universities, despite the fact that universities are owned by the states. But yet, and I think they fund TAFE, but it's TAFE's run by states as well as public schools. So who's responsible there? So we always end up in this yet again finger pointing. So I would like to see health become a federal responsibility, and especially so in the wake of COVID. And I think if these bushfires and COVID have taught us anything, whether you like it or not, idealistically, I don't like Canberra getting too much power, but practically, whether you like it or not, the nation turns towards its prime minister in this day and age. And it's all very well saying it's the state's responsibility as the bushfires were, but I tell you what, try getting that message across in the bushfires. It just didn't happen. It's the same with, the border issue now and different states with different regulations throughout the COVID crisis. So I think we do need to look at refreshing and reforming our federation. Whether or not we go as far as abolishing the states, I'm not quite there yet. I mean, I won't argue with people who say we should. I think there's valid reasons why we should, but there's also valid reasons why we shouldn't. But what we certainly need is a better accountability regimes in place. And the only way we can do that is to say, right, this level of government deals with this and this level of government deals with that, in particular health, federal education, the states. And one other thing I'd like to see is payroll tax abolished at the states. They managed to nationalise the Corporations Act in 2001. They should have nationalised, at the very least nationalised, payroll tax then, because you've got different rates, different thresholds. But not only that, it's just a dumb tax to tax people to employ people. You take a farmer who, say, for example, has a $20 million turnover, employs 500 people to pick the fruit to get that turnover, he will pay payroll tax. On the other hand, you can and he can export that fruit. So we're taxing someone that employs people and exports. On the other hand, you can have a car dealer that might sell 20 Ferraris for $20 million a year, but only needs three people and doesn't pay payroll tax. So where's the logic? It's just a silly tax. So I would argue get rid of payroll tax, bring back stamp duty at the national level, and then distribute that along with GST as a percentage of population, which my understanding of it is Deakin did that, brought that in 1905 right up to 1930, and you just distribute GST stamp duty on a percentage of population. None of this dark arts of the Grants Commission, where, you know, if one state, for example, generates more mining royalties, they get penalised. And as a Queenslander, and I'll speak on behalf of Western Australians here, it's very unfair that those states get penalised for increased royalties for mining, but yet the New South Wales and Victoria doesn't get penalised for increased payroll receipts, because the head offices, like BHP's head offices in Victoria, it's not in Perth, where it should be, given that most of its revenue comes from Perth, or likewise here, you know, we're the biggest exporter of coal in the country, but a lot of the head offices are in Sydney and Melbourne. So, I've got a real beef with the way GST is distributed as well. I just think go percentage of population. Queensland's 20% of the population, give us 20%. If you want to do competitive federalism, that's the best way to do it, because the GST system currently at the moment rewards non-productive behaviour rather than productive behaviour as well.
And just before we close, I just wanted to touch on the big question of China, US, Australia. Do you think we can keep a foot in both camps?
Look, we've got to deal with what's in front of us. I'm very much a non-interventionalist, and I'm a big fan of Eisenhower's Chance for Peace speech, where he said, basically, no nation's security and well-being can be achieved in isolation, but only in effective cooperation with other nations. And the other speech that I love is the one that Ronald Reagan gave in 1984, his address on Soviet Union relations, where he quoted Kennedy, and he said, basically, we've got to focus on our common interests. And he said, if Anya and Ivan were sitting in a bus stop with Jim and Sally, what would they be talking about? And he said they'd be talking about their kids, their livelihoods, their jobs. They wouldn't be talking about government and philosophy. And we've got to remember, and I was lucky enough when I travelled the world to see 85 countries, and if there's one thing I learned out of all those travels, is that we're all the same. And the world's a beautiful place full of beautiful people, and I'd like to keep it that way. So, sure, we've got our differences, but let's try to find common ground on those differences and work through it. Remembering, and I'll just finish with this, I remember when I went through the old Silk Route through Western China and passed up through Xi'an, where the Terracotta Warriors are. I was on an overland truck trip at the time, and we were leaving that morning, and the guy who owned the hotel that had us there that night, he was waving us off as we left. He was sitting there in what looked like stubbies, a singlet, had a durry out his mouth, a beer in one hand, and he let off these fireworks. And I remember thinking this was back in the 90s. You know, the Chinese people are just as capitalist as we all are. And we should always remember it's always about the people. And as you know, as Reagan said, it's not the people that start wars, it's governments do. So, you know, let's try and find some common ground while, you know, always, you know, standing up for our own values as well.
Well, it's been a very interesting conversation. Just before I let you go, of all the things you've touched on, which is the one that you think is the most critical to make the most progress on immediately?
Monetary policy, because it's something that's not well understood by the people. It's probably politically the easiest thing to get through because taxes will always involve a political fight. Regulation will always involve a political fight. Federation issue will be a massive fight. But monetary policy is something that I think we can deal with, and I think it's actually the big stick. You know, we often do rats and mice with fiscal policy, and yet here on the other side we have billions of dollars of capital. Like our net investment position is $1 trillion. You know, we have $1 trillion invested off, you know, by foreign interests here. You know, if you look at, say, for example, the US federal government, the Federal Reserve, sorry, it's printed up, it's I think it's now up to $7 trillion. If I think, and I think Australia's population is about a 13th the size of the US. So if we divided that by a 13th, that'd be, say, half a trillion. You know, with that, I'm not saying we go that hard, by the way, but I just think it'd be a lot easier to expand our own balance sheet. And don't get bogged down by debt, remember, because Japan's debt to GDP is 220% and Argentina's was less than 100% the last time it defaulted. But because Japan's debt's to its central bank, its central bank won't default on the country, right? So we're really, when we don't control our currency, we don't control our economy. And when we let someone else's currency come here into Australia, we're basically giving up our sovereignty over those particular assets to an extent. I mean, not completely, but we aren't really garnishing the profits that we could be.
Right. And I guess if you take monetary policy and then segue that into the national bank, which is effectively where you can then farm that investment out and then start investing for growth and opportunity in the future, that you can see how this could work quite well.
Well, absolutely. And it's where the infrastructure bank is where monetary policy meets fiscal policy. You know, Philip Lowe, he says that, you know, government should get out and spend more. Well, where do you expect us to get the money from? Well, small business to go out and spend more. I mean, if we go out and borrow foreign debt, we've got to pay interest on that, which is, you know, a drag on economy. And what you want is to raise taxes, which is going to be a drag on economy. You know, and this is what I mean about the Dippy Bird. I mean, he should get a little bit creative himself because he's unaccountable. I mean, he can get away with this and no one would have a clue. If he came out and said we're going to issue $100 billion in bonds to the Commonwealth government next Tuesday, you know, next first Tuesday of the month, I don't think just about hardly anyone would blink an eyelid. I mean, a few people who understand monetary policy would. But that would be a handful of people.
Yep. Gerard, well, I really appreciate your time. It's been a really interesting conversation. And thank you very much for taking us through some of those really important platforms. And I think you're onto something there. So we'll get this up and out on YouTube as soon as we can.
Thank you very much, Martin. It was great giving me the time to speak to you today. And keep up the good work yourself. You do some good work on your podcasts.
Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you.